I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. The aftershocks from Donald Trump's victory in the United States presidential election have continued to hit here in Australia and to stoke anxieties among US allies about what it means for them. To discuss the security implications of a Trump presidency, we're joined by Professor Rory Medcalf, a former diplomat and intelligence analyst who is now head of the National Security College at the Australian National University. Rory Medcalf, you've written that the prospect of a Trump presidency is what futures analysts call a black elephant. A strategic shock, or so-called black swan, combined with the elephant in the room. How does the reality of a Trump presidency affect Australia?
Well, Michelle, I think that analogy is really quite right because, the elephant in the room, of course, is the big problem that we refuse to acknowledge or we refuse to talk about. And a black swan is a perhaps slightly insulting for Australians, but still a dramatic way of describing a surprise or a shock, and usually a bad surprise or a bad shock in international security. So for Australia, I think the shock of the Trump presidency will mean that we have to think much more seriously about what our foreign policy and national security looks like with an unpredictable American ally. I don't think it's the end of the alliance. I think there's been some overblown commentary about the end of the alliance, or indeed about perhaps Australia turning to China, for example. I think that's not the case. But I do think that Australia knows now that we can't simply rely on the strategic direction that America is setting in the Asia-Pacific or the Indo-Pacific region, because I suspect under Trump, for quite a while, the Americans won't know that themselves. The other point I'd make is that there will be many other American allies and partners in the region and around the world and countries that are interested in an international system based on rules and international law that suit the interests of middle players, that will all be quite anxious about what a Trump presidency means for them. So we're in good company.
While it's not obviously the end of the alliance, does it mean, however, that we should step back from the alliance, the intimacy of the alliance to a degree, or that we will be forced to do so?
Well, the challenge here in part is that Australia's national security interests are simply so extensive and so large, and our ability to protect and advance those interests on our own is so limited that in the medium term, stepping back from the alliance is not really an option anyway, unless the Australian public were willing to accept a very high degree of risk and vulnerability that no Australian government could, manage against. I don't think it's a realistic proposition. But there are things that we can do. I think that, for a start, it is a fact that our defence technology and intelligence is deeply reliant and connected with American capabilities and systems. And while that will remain the case, there's more we can do to build more of our own, I guess, independent or quarantined capabilities that we can also draw upon. I would like to see Australia become very resilient in areas like cybersecurity, for example, regardless of which way the alliance goes. We also, I think, need to diversify a lot of our strategic relationships more than we have. I think it wasn't that long ago that some people were, very critical of the closeness we were achieving with Japan, for example. But in fact, in some ways, Japan could end up being a more capable and like-minded partner in the region if America plays a less reliable role. But not just Japan. India, Indonesia, Singapore, there's a whole lot of countries that are looking to one another, and we're one of them. We're hedging against what I would call, on the one hand, Chinese power, because I think there remain anxieties about Chinese power in the region, but American unpredictability on the other. And all of those possibilities, to me, point to Australia needing to build up more significant capabilities of its own so we've got choices in the future.
But the whole thrust of what has been happening surely in recent years has been to integrate our capability with that of the United States. To what extent is it possible, given the expense of these sorts of commitments and the timelines, which are very long, to chop and change?
Look, it is going to be extremely hard, and I think we certainly shouldn't be prematurely sort of saying, well, let's stop the integration. But I do think that we need to find more creative ways of being integrated at one level, whether it's in defence technology or intelligence, but maintaining the highest possible level of strategic autonomy as to the actual choices we make about what we do with our capabilities. And there are many countries that do rely very heavily on the United States for their defence technology, but are not always in lockstep with every US strategic or foreign policy decision. I think also that we could turn this around a little bit and suggest that there's going to be a much greater expectation on Australia now to try to shape or influence America's choices and to encourage America to make sensible choices and to be the kind of ally that we would like to be integrated with. And that's obviously going to be harder than it was, but we're going to also have to try much harder than we have, and also to do that in tandem with a whole range of allies and partners to make that happen.
Do you think that is realistic, though? We talk about having greater influence, but given that the Trump administration looks to be going to be pretty unpredictable, is there any reason why President Trump and his advisers would particularly listen to any other countries?
Very good question, and I think part of the answer to that is the importance now on those other countries of doing more together and for themselves. So, for example, I would say that in Asia, in the Indo-Pacific, if you looked at Australia, Japan, India, for example, three countries that now have their own strategic dialogue, that's a dialogue that where I am sure next time we get together we will be talking very hard around how do we together influence America's strategic direction in ways that suit us and suit regional stability. The short answer is allies and partners are going to have to work in multiples of two or three or more to try to get that kind of influence to bear on the United States. It is going to be hard for any single ally to do it. Having said that, Australia does have an unusual place, perhaps even in Trump's worldview. I suspect he has a pretty simplistic view of Australia as being essentially an uncomplicated, loyal ally that loves America. Well, of course, we're a more complex country than that, and so there'll be a really important role now for the Australian government to influence and educate Trump's advisers and hope that he gets a reasonable set of advisers around him.
For years now, the foreign policy talk has been preoccupied with Australia balancing the importance of the alliance, but also, on the other hand, our economic relationship with China. To what extent do you think that balancing act will become more complicated in the Trump world?
Look, it will be complicated. It is complicated, but it's also much more sort of multipolar, I think, than that analogy suggests. If you think about it, we're not just trying to balance an economic relationship with China against a strategic relationship with America. The foreign investment relationship between Australia and America is actually much, much larger than the Australia-China investment story. There are other significant relationships in the region, you know, Japan, South Korea, India and others that I've mentioned. There's also, you know, some interesting connections with Europe that get downplayed a little bit in the Indo-Pacific. And of course, France is now very much back on the map for us with submarines and more. So I think Australia is now going to have to play a very nimble, multipolar balancing game among many powers and many players, and not simply China and America, because, of course, what we've seen this year, I think, is growing concern about Chinese power and influence in Australia, including within Australian politics, at the same time as new unpredictability and uncertainty about the sort of ally America could be. So clearly, we can't put all our eggs into either of these baskets.
Just taking up that point of growing concern, do you think that concern is justified?
Absolutely. You mean regarding Chinese influence?
Yes.
In this? Yeah, I think that there has been a rising awareness this year that for whatever reason, at various levels, there is growing Chinese involvement and Chinese Communist Party involvement in seeking to influence decisions, directions, policy, public attitudes in Australian affairs, particularly around China's behaviour in the region and the South China Sea and so forth, also about our attitudes to the alliance. And this is a new problem, whether it's the issue of political donations or whether it's the issue of Chinese ownership, Chinese Communist Party ownership, effectively, of Chinese language media in Australia, that sort of thing. It's a as yet fairly complicated, multifaceted tapestry of influence, which I think our security agencies, our government, our political system hasn't yet worked out how to manage in order to preserve Australia's democratic processes and strategic sovereignty.
There's been a lot of talk about the political donations and also, of course, the acquisition of land, but there hasn't been much talk about the Chinese media in Australia. What's happening there?
So it's pretty well documented now that interests connected with the Chinese Communist Party have almost monopoly ownership of Chinese language media in Australia. In other words, a significant proportion of Australian nationals or Chinese Australians or Chinese nationals in Australia get their principal news sources about the world through media outlets that are censored by the Chinese Communist Party. That is a significant degree of, if you like, foreign political involvement and influence in Australian domestic affairs.
And how extensive is that Chinese media in Australia?
So radio stations, newspapers, it's widely documented.
Actually based here?
Based here, operating here. In other words, you switch on the radio. You switch on the radio in Melbourne, you pick up a newspaper in Sydney, it's essentially vetted by the Chinese Communist Party.
And do you think that this is seen as an important weapon of soft diplomacy?
I think it is certainly a tool of influence, and I think it would be interesting to see if, whether, for example, you know, in reverse, if there were essentially sources of influence from other countries within China like this, how long that would be tolerated for. But of course, within a democratic system, naturally we want to encourage and support a diversity of views. The problem is that I think just as we've seen in a very different way with the use of social media through the US election campaign and the use of misinformation and propaganda connected with Russian interests in the US election campaign, it's getting much easier these days in an interconnected world for authoritarian countries to exert information influence inside democratic countries, but the opposite is much, much more difficult to do.
To come back to President-elect Trump, Malcolm Turnbull's taken the approach of trying to get in on the ground floor, having an early conversation with him, stressing their mutual business backgrounds and so on. Do you think that that is a wise strategy at this stage?
It's probably all that he can do. I do think that something that would be advisable would be a little bit more of the rhetoric, such as we've heard from German Chancellor Merkel, that reiterates the alliance and the importance of the relationship, but puts it in the context of our own values, our principles, our support for a rules-based order and human rights. I think that was a really valuable marker that the German Chancellor laid down, and I think it wouldn't hurt for other American allies to be saying similar things. So I guess if there's one piece of context or one piece of additional messaging that it would be good to see the Australian government sending, it would be that. However, it's pretty unavoidable and sensible that we should otherwise take a pragmatic approach to the alliance and really try and get a clearer sense of Trump's direction and expectations and identify as much continuity and commonality as we can.
Do you think that someone with Malcolm Turnbull's background and personality is well placed to deal with Donald Trump?
Look, I think the reference
get commonality.
I think the reference to a business career is sensible and kind of obvious, and I think that's a useful point. I don't think they're ideological soulmates, and I don't think they would see themselves as that. But I think the emphasis on some pragmatism and some experience outside politics doesn't hurt.
Now, you mentioned the talk of values, and Labor, Bill Shorten and others in Labor have been stressing this quite a deal, have been saying that while they remain very committed to the American alliance, we should stand up for our values and essentially not endorse the sort of values on certain grounds that the president-elect has. What do you think of the Labor approach?
Look, I think we do need as a country to put the alliance, if you like, in one box, in one category, but also emphasise that endorsing the alliance and valuing the relationship so highly with the United States as we do doesn't mean that Australia's comfortable, or that most Australians, I suspect, are comfortable with a lot of the rhetoric and a lot of the ugliness that we saw and heard during the US election campaign, and that obviously is there in some elements of Trump's base and of Trump's team, or of Trump himself. But having said that, I think the Labor approach this week has been really interesting, and I think quite commendable in some ways. I think the comments that that Penny Wong has made in, I think, an opinion article recently have echoed in an Australian way the sort of approach that Chancellor Merkel has taken, that championing of values, Australian interests and Australian rights. So I think that's to be commended. It would be good to see bipartisanship on that point, because I do think that one of the risks and one of the dangers and one of the lessons that we've seen from the US election campaign is what happens when consensus on foreign and security policy gets smashed, and we want to avoid that happening here.
In this sort of hyper-partisan atmosphere that we're living in domestically, however, do you think it's possible to get that bipartisanship?
I think it's possible, but it's going to be very difficult, and it will take an informal agreement to quarantine security and foreign policy issues from this partisan cut and thrust. And of course, there's not a lot of sign of that at the moment.
We are obviously also seeing the whole Trump phenomenon bleeding into our domestic politics quite a lot, and Bill Shorten in particular is talking in the same sort of language of discontent that we've seen from many in the United States. Trump is, of course, a hyper version of this, but more generally. Is this surprising you, or do you think that this is inevitable? Is this another facet, indeed, of globalisation?
Well, we certainly shouldn't be encouraging that kind of discontent. I think our political class certainly shouldn't be encouraging anything that seems like, I guess, discontent regarding foreign workers or that kind of thing. But I do think there is some inevitability to it. I'm a little bit comforted by the fact that there are a whole lot of safeguards, if you like, in Australia that don't exist in the United States and probably haven't existed in the UK this year either, that I think mean that the rise of extreme politics, far-right views, and essentially an angry revolt against the elites isn't going to happen here on anything like the same scale or pace as we've seen in the UK or the US. I think compulsory voting is a major advantage Australia has. We tend to forget that only about 18 or 19% of Americans actually voted for Donald Trump. So in that sense, I think compulsory voting is a major benefit that the moderate centre has. I also think that even with the hardship of parts of the Australian community, issues like home ownership, property values and so forth do give a significant buffer against the kinds of poverty and sense of anger that we've seen in the United States. So I certainly think it's way too early for us to be assuming that there'll be some kind of need to pander to the far right here in Australia.
So do you think that Bill Shorten's gone too far, for example, in his concerns this week about foreign workers?
I think it's not necessary to be as partisan about that issue as we've seen, but that's a little bit beyond my national security area of expertise.
And while we're very different in this country, is there a danger of complacency, thinking we are so different. Because, for example, we did see Pauline Hanson's party get quite a lot of votes in the last election. We're seeing a louder and louder section of the Commentariat, which is running fairly hard right positions.
Mm. Look, I think the response to this is obviously to be aware of grievance and aware of any kind of reasonable, legitimate grievance in society, and there are plenty of reasons for grievance in many, many parts of the community, but to focus heavily on strengthening, and I think radically strengthening, the moderate centre of our politics, and that will involve trying to build as much common ground, particularly on foreign and security policy issues, between the major parties, rather than using these issues as fodder for partisanship.
And just finally, to what extent has the world dramatically changed with this US election? Will we look back on this in 10 or 20 years and think this was a huge point in history? Or will we see it in a different and less dramatic context?
Look, the short answer is we don't know. And anyone who tells you that they do, I think, is most interested in getting attention rather than getting it right. But it could certainly be the beginning of some kind of turning point. And I think what's critical now is what happens next.
A turning point for the worse?
Potentially. And I think certainly a lot of old certainties are now in question. I think that countries like China and Russia are going to feel emboldened, particularly Russia. I think US allies around the world are going to be feeling anxious. And there is this potential for a ripple effect of far-right political views, particularly in Europe, more so in Europe, I would say, than in this country. So all of that's true. But on the other hand, we need to see really how a Trump administration responds to the first few security crises that will come. Within the first few months, you will see North Korea, Russia, China, Islamic State all testing the boundaries, all trying to find weak points, vulnerabilities, areas where they can push their interests against America's. And it will be how the United States responds to those crises, not of its own making, that will, I think, determine whether we're seeing the beginning of a really dramatic shift in world affairs, or whether we're seeing essentially America hold the line on the rules-based order that we've seen over the past few decades. I would say that if that happens, then if we do see a deterioration in world order and stability, if we see, for example, the US either fail to back up its allies against some of these challenges, or if we see the US behave in an unpredictable and destabilising way under Trump, if either of those things happen, then we'll see the period from, I guess, 1989 until 2016 as a very clear period of relative stability and dominance of liberal democratic values in the world, and we will see a darker period coming next. But I do think the next few months are critical, and I think now is the time for allies and partners of the United States to really help America to help itself.
Some potentially dramatic and testing times ahead. Rory Metcalfe, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. This is Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.